Today is Wednesday, February 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, COVID-19. The UN Secretary General says it's a massive problem that requires a massive response.
It's not out of control, but it is a very dangerous situation. And the risks are enormous, and we need to be prepared worldwide for that.
President Trump goes on a major pardoning spree. Also ahead, Democratic presidential candidates are gearing up for another debate and the next voting contest. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, since his impeachment acquittal by the Senate, the president has targeted those who stood against him during the impeachment process and extended favors to allies while moving to fill his administration with loyalists. As VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wuttakuswara takes a look at what the president is doing to consolidate power as he heads into the battle for re-election.
In front of cheering fans, Donald Trump took the Beast, the armored presidential limousine, for a lap around the Daytona 500 racetrack over the weekend, a first in American history.
Trump is a character who enjoys the large gesture, the bold move, and this has characterized his entire public life since he was a private citizen.
Trump's bold moves recently also include pressuring federal prosecutors to reduce prison time for his longtime political advisor, Roger Stone, who was found guilty of lying to investigators, obstructing Congress, and witness intimidation in the case of Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. election.
He was treated very badly, 9 years recommended by four people that perhaps they were Mueller people. I don't know who they were, prosecutors.
Presidents rarely comment on pending cases to avoid giving the impression they are influencing the legal process. But Trump has broken with such precedents. Trump also touted his firing of the U.S. Ambassador to European Union, Gordon Sondland, and Alexander Vindman, Director for European Affairs at the National Security Council. Both men testified against the president during his impeachment trial.
His conduct after his acquittal really confirms people's worst fears about him, which is that that he doesn't really have the temperament that people would like to have in a president. People are not looking for a president who's vindictive in his conduct and behavior.
The president's supporters reject such criticisms and say he is rewarding political loyalists as all presidents do, purging the National Security Council of Obama-era personnel and bringing back former Communications Director Hope Hicks as counselor to the president and former personal assistant John McKenty to oversee the presidential personnel office.
He wants to surround himself with people he trusts, and try to limit the exposure to people who he does not know or to people who have been part of the bureaucracy, which we've seen opposes him at every juncture since he became president.
Trump is also betting the strong economy will help secure his re-election, even if some supporters are turned off by his blunt personal style.
Nobody makes the case of the problems with President Trump's character better than President Trump himself. That people see that every day. And in our polling, we know that there's a substantial chunk of voters who say, I kind of agree with him on the issues, but I don't like the way he conducts himself.
With the election more than 8 months away, Trump is already campaigning aggressively and stockpiling funds, with $200 million already in the bank and campaign-related travel every week. Patsy Wuttakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Well, a week after Attorney General William Barr overturned the Justice Department's recommendation for a stiff prison sentence for U.S. President Donald Trump's friend Roger Stone, the public uproar over political meddling in the system of justice continues. A federal judge Tuesday said Stone will be sentenced Thursday while she decides whether to grant the presidential friend's request for a new trial. Roger Stone was convicted last November on 7 counts, including lying to Congress about his role in Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election and tampering with a witness. The president also has railed against Judge Amy Berman Jackson for subjecting another former associate to solitary confinement. It prompted a National Association of Federal Judges to call an emergency meeting later today. Joining us for analysis on all of this is law professor Joel Richard Paul from the University of California, Hastings in San Francisco. What's your view on these unprecedented public statements from U.S. attorneys and judges, a group of federal judges, over the Attorney General's actions?
I think that the reason that presidents generally try to avoid commenting on cases that are before the court, particularly cases in which the Department of Justice has an interest, is precisely because it's difficult to know then where the fair administration of justice begins and where politics starts. And I think what the president has done by his interference in these various cases is to really erase that line. So we don't really know whether the Department of Justice is acting in good faith in recommending the reductions of sentences. It doesn't look that way because of the president's tweeting, and we don't really know why he has chosen to attack this judge with false accusations, but it looks as if he's trying to protect his former associates. And we have actions today of his pardoning seven white-collar criminals, all of whom have been convicted of crimes of corruption and tax fraud, and who appear to have powerful associates who have contributed large amounts of money to the president. These kinds of actions begin to color people's perceptions about the fair administration of justice. And I think what the Judges Association is doing and what the former prosecutors are doing with their various protests is to try to send a signal both to the president and to the attorney general that they really need to back off, to let the courts do their job independently. The independence of our judiciary is the backbone of a system of a rule of law, and that's what is now threatened.
Do you think that these people starting to speak out, obviously they're concerned about what they're seeing, do you think it's enough to have an impact? Do you think Attorney General Barr is taking notice? They're calling, U.S. attorneys are calling for him to resign because, you know, he's making decisions, as they say, more as if he were the president's attorney than the nation's attorney.
I think the chorus of protests is going to continue and get louder. I don't know that the Attorney General is going to resign, but if I were at the Attorney General, I would certainly be concerned about my legacy and my reputation. Attorney General Barr had a fine reputation when he served in the George W. Bush administration. He was regarded as a completely legitimate, thoughtful, honest Attorney General, and I think his reputation now is being tarred by the president's actions, and the attorney general at some point may choose to resign just to avoid further damaging his otherwise good reputation. And I also suspect that there will be some actions by Congress in response to these various actions. I mean, one of the concerns that I have right now is that the Department of Justice is continuing to investigate allegations brought by the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, of Hunter Biden and Vice President Biden. And these allegations would seem to have no substance. And, you know, maybe there's something there, but the fact that the president is pushing this as part of his political agenda really taints the whole process.
All right, that's Joel Paul. He is a law professor at the University of California, Hastings in San Francisco. U.S. presidential contest has moved to the sparsely populated state of Nevada, which holds its nominating caucuses coming up on Saturday. Although thousands have cast their ballots in early voting, the candidates are competing for the votes of 200,000 union members as well. But as VOA's Carolyn Pursuti reports from Las Vegas, securing union backing is more challenging now than in previous election years.
U.S. labor unions historically have played a powerful role in politics. At their peak, 21 million workers were unionized nationwide. Decades ago, getting organized labor's endorsement could almost guarantee a candidate's victory. That's still true here in Nevada, home to casinos and the still powerful culinary union with 60,000 members. The union has endorsed numerous candidates in its 84 years, but not now. Instead, choosing to promote labor's priorities and goals rather than rallying behind a single candidate in the primary.
We're going to endorse our goals, what we're doing. That's what we're going to endorse.
Are you ready for me? Deirdre Felgar worked for years in a union job. She wishes that everyone would join forces to support one Democrat to defeat President Donald Trump in November.
Many voices speak louder than one.
Anyone who eats at the Fremont Hotel and Casino might see longtime Culinary Union member Jason Miranda, who works in kitchen supplies. He says he didn't wait for his union's endorsement to vote in the caucuses.
Main issues, probably health care, protect our health care.
While the Culinary Union didn't endorse, it did warn members that Senator Bernie Sanders' government-funded Medicare for All would end union-negotiated private health insurance. Again, Miranda is unfazed.
I think Bernie Sanders is a very decent man.
Gary Bauman has been a member of the taxi union for more than 40 years. He voted early for the candidate he believes most likely to defeat Trump.
I'm pretty split between Joe Biden and Amy Klobuchar.
Bauman bought a house from his taxi earnings, but says that would be impossible today as organized labor's clout has waned.
They're going to have bartenders that are machines and a lot of other things like that. So there's going to be a big fight here.
Analysts say the candidate most likely to be hurt by no union endorsement is former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden, with his longtime ties to unions, is in need of a win after weak showings in Iowa and New Hampshire. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Las Vegas, Nevada.
Well, as the number of coronavirus cases continues to rise, representatives of the World Health Organization and other experts emphasize the importance of data sharing by affected countries to minimize the global impact and help prevent the virus's spread. VOA's Julie Thibault has more.
China has now reported more than 72,000 cases of the coronavirus, including more than 1,800 deaths.
At the moment, we don't have enough data on cases outside China to make a meaningful comparison on the severity of disease or the case fatality rate. We're following up with countries to get more information about what happens about each case and the outcome.
The WHO Director General said it's crucial for impacted countries to be transparent and share information with the World Health Organization so it can help.
These signals show the importance of all countries being ready for the arrival of the virus, to treat patients with dignity and compassion, to protect health workers, and to prevent onward transmission.
Professor Eileen Marty says the reaction by some governments has been inconsistent.
Some governments have been more strict, some less. Some have imposed trade barriers, some have imposed travel barriers, and the degree of those barriers differ by the different places and their own capacities.
Regarding the spread of the virus on the docked Japanese Diamond Princess cruise ship, Michael Ryan, executive director of the WHO Health Emergency Program, says there have been more transmissions than expected.
It's an unfortunate event occurring on the ship, and we trust that the authorities in Japan and the governments who are taking back people will be able to follow up those individuals in the appropriate way to ensure that they get the appropriate care if there are cases, and if not, that they are reintegrated into their communities.
And while vaccine development is important, experts say it's not necessarily a top priority at the moment.
We all want to invest in the vaccine as a long-term solution, but there are people sick now, and there are health systems that are vulnerable now. So we need to balance our investments and invest in the weaker health systems and our own systems, and then we do the other things, and we develop the vaccine.
We have to make sure that vaccine doesn't hurt you. So safety studies, and that takes time. That takes at least a month or 3 months to put to have volunteers use that and see people who are even exposed and see if they have any risk.
Julie Thibault, VOA News, Washington.
Well, meanwhile, many countries set up border screenings and airlines canceled flights to and from China to prevent further spread of the disease, which has been detected in around 24 countries and caused almost 1,000 confirmed cases outside of mainland China. Separately, the UN Secretary General tells reporters the virus outbreak is not out of control, but is very dangerous. Antonio Guterres telling the Associated Press in an interview in Lahore, Pakistan, that countries with robust health systems need to help more vulnerable nations.
Our main concern, I have to say, is in relation to countries that have very weak health services. And so I think a particular attention should be put into helping, if necessary, for instance, African countries.
Calling for a higher state of preparedness, Guterres also says the risks are enormous and the world needs to, just in general, have a higher state of awareness.
I don't think it's spiraling out of control. I think it's a massive problem. A massive problem that has required from China a massive response.
With a world population without immunity and so much still unknown, is the growing global fear warranted? Joining us now is Peter Collingnon, infectious diseases physician and microbiologist at Australia's Canberra Hospital.
Well, I think that's difficult to answer, and I think we'll be wiser in a couple of months' time. At the moment, it appears that this virus is spreading just really from person to person. It may have come from animals in the first place, like a bat, but now it's all person to person. And the real problem is that there's probably people with minimal symptoms who are infected, and they're not being detected. So I guess that's good news in that it means this virus may not be as bad as it initially sounded. But still the available evidence suggests that it's got, you know, at least a mortality above 1 in 1,000 or 0.1%. And the latest figures I saw in healthcare workers, it was about 0.3%. And you can say, well, why are we worrying? Well, the reason is that this spreads widely around the world. If the mortality is even as low as 0.1%, if it spreads to 1 million people, that's 1,000 people that are likely to have died. So that's a big deal. Now, the good news is that I don't think it spreads as widely and as quickly as influenza, at least on the available evidence at the moment, in that when we look at what's happened in countries where it hasn't been before, the US, Canada, Australia, even Singapore, and where there's good follow-up, we're not seeing the same spread as we would with, for instance, when we saw swine flu in 2009. So that's the good news. The bad news is, however, it is spread widely. Now, when you look at data from China, and which is available from the government there, the only other good news is this is still mainly in Hubei and particularly in Wuhan as a city. So again, that implies that there is some ability to maybe control the spread, although the cruise ship episode in Japan makes you worry because there's probably, you know, over 500 people out of 3,500 who have become infected, although a lot with mild symptoms, but that's a fairly high infection rate because it's 10 to 15%. So there's a lot we don't know, and at the moment it's reasonable to try and stop the movement of people. To what extreme you go, as is what they've done in China too far, well, for most people in the US and Australia where I'm from, we'd think yes. But I guess we won't know and won't be wise for another couple of months.
If we don't have immunity to this and we don't have a cure for this or a vaccine yet, no matter how much you try to quarantine people, when so many may have it and just be walking around and not even know because they have no symptoms, how do you ever get something like this under control?
Well, I think that's the problem. I mean, I think if you look at it, you think, oh, what's our chance of controlling this? I would think it's less than 50%. We are at least appear to be slowing it down, and that may buy us time. You know, if we slow it down for a month, I guess that's another month we've had up our sleeve before a vaccine's available. But realistically, there's not going to be a vaccine with billions of doses, which is what we need if this goes around the world, for at least 18 months or 2 years by the time you develop one, do the safety studies in animals and people, and then work out whether it works. And particularly that some vaccines can actually enhance infection, such as some of the earlier dengue vaccines. So there's a lot of work before you have a vaccine. So I guess we could just all throw up our hands and say, well, there's nothing we can do about it, let's do nothing. But that will be at a cost, probably, of letting it spread more widely and more quickly than trying to do something. And again, the only good news is, from my perspective, if you look at the figures in China, and particularly what's happening in other provinces, and if you look at what's happened out of China, there is a possibility we may be able to control this. And my feeling is we should make an effort, but if it looks like this is going totally out of control, then I fully accept that, well, you know, we're going to have a different approach. But the only other thing I could say that might be good news for the majority of the world's population, who are relatively younger, is this mainly is causing severe disease in those who are older, mm-hmm. And those with underlying disease, and those who are smokers, because smoking may do something different to the receptors you have. So there's another good reason to give up smoking, but it also just highlights the fact that just all the standard things we should do every, you know, winter season in particular, but don't, you know, wash our hands if we're sick, keep away from other people, distancing, wear a mask if you, you know, can't keep your distance from other people, both to protect yourself and maybe to protect others if you're coughing, because it means you don't touch your nose and your mouth as much. All those things we say to do every year, including using alcohol hand rubs, we should do even more conscientiously this around now, and particularly where it's winter, which is the Northern Hemisphere, because that increases the chance of transmitting every virus, not just this one.
All right, that's Peter Collignon, infectious diseases physician and microbiologist at Australia's Canberra Hospital. Thank you for being with us. Here are some of the other stories we're following at voanews.com. The UN rights chief says he's horrified by violence against civilians in Syria. UN says Libyan rival forces have resumed talks to save their ceasefire. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is facing an uphill battle to win over African leaders. And Uganda deploys an army to battle East Africa's locust invasion. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrives in Riyadh later today at the time of heightened tensions in the Middle East. Some issues on the agenda include tensions with Iran, the Trump administration's Mideast peace plan, the ongoing war in Yemen, and human rights issues. VOA's Ardita Dunalari reports the meetings take place at a time when both countries are calibrating their approach to opening regional matters amid aimed at their bilateral relations.
The United States and Saudi Arabia have long shared a concern about Iran's nuclear ambitions and its destabilizing activities in the Middle East. But experts say Saudi Arabia wants the U.S. to take a tougher stance. Riyadh believes Iran's attack on Saudi oil facilities last September drew only a tepid response from Washington. This is just one of the concerns Saudi officials are expected to bring up in talks with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, says Middle East expert Badr al-Said.
And that has sent the alarms off for the Saudis that they need to act alone to preserve their security. And I think the visit by Pompeo will be along those lines.
The killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in January by a U.S. missile strike raised the stakes for conflict in the region. The Saudis, says al-Saif, have signaled they want a voice in any decision the U.S. takes going forward.
The U.S. understands that they cannot forge a bloc against Iran without the cooperation of the Saudis. They are a regional hegemon as well, and they need to be treated as equally.
The war in Yemen between Iran-backed Houthi rebels and government forces supported by Saudi Arabia continues to be a source of friction with Washington. Congress has pressured the Trump administration to withdraw military aid for Saudi Arabia in an effort to reduce violence in Yemen. Congress also has opposed aid to Saudi Arabia after the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside a Saudi consulate in Turkey. But Saudi Arabia's human rights record is not likely to be a major obstacle to its relations with the Trump administration.
Human rights was not a priority, was never a priority in the Saudi-U.S. relationship under this administration, and it's not a priority for the Trump administration and the region in general. It is not just particular to Saudi Arabia.
More than 500 days after Khashoggi's death, Saudi authorities have not released details of the investigation or the ensuing trial. Professor al-Saif cautions against applying Western standards when it comes to assessing human rights in Saudi Arabia.
They do have their own definition of what human rights are, and they would adhere to it. This is not unique to Saudi Arabia. We've heard the same thing happen in Russia, in China, and other non-Western contexts as well.
The U.S. administration is also looking for Saudi engagement in support of its Israeli-Palestinian peace plan, which is strongly opposed by the Palestinians. It remains unclear what support Saudi Arabia can offer to convince the Palestinians to come to an agreement. Ardita Dunelari, VOA News, Washington.
This is International Edition. We'll be right back.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior, and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. As desert locusts spread across East Africa, Uganda's deploying its army to battle the all-consuming horde as the pests lay countless eggs expected to hatch within weeks, raising concerns among farmers that the worst is yet to come. Halima Athumani reports from Northeast Uganda.
Uganda is the latest East African country battling an invasion of millions of desert locusts after the pest this month crossed the Kenya border. Farmers such as Thomas Onyango in Oringoliet village woke one morning to find his garden being consumed.
Half of the garden, there are no leaves on the cassava. When you check on the pigeon peas, all the leaves are gone. Even the fruits that I was expecting to harvest now, they are all down on the ground.
Authorities say about 20 districts in northeast Uganda so far are affected. To fight back, Uganda deployed 2,000 troops armed with pesticide. But Major General Sam Kavuma says the locusts are skilled in evading their counterattacks.
One challenge which is being solved, that is aerial support to spray them, you know, from air, because for us we deal much with those which are on the ground, and when we kill them or during the spray, then they jump and go on top of the trees where our pumps cannot reach.
Ugandan authorities say they are working to secure helicopters for aerial spraying. Meanwhile, the army is stretched as it chases the constantly moving swarms, and locals are left to their own devices to try to scare away the bugs.
That locust, they are eating grass where my animals, goat, cows, and others.
Locust experts say if the swarms are not stopped, the eggs they are laying now will hatch within 2 weeks and the invading numbers will skyrocket.
What it means is that if eggs are laid and successfully hatch, then we are going into another generation, and that generation will have multiplied up to 4 or 5 times the original population. So it's a huge increase. It's an increase that can be frightening.
Experts say warm weather and heavy rains around the Red Sea coast triggered massive locust breeding in Djibouti, Eritrea, and Sudan. The pests have been devouring crops in Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, Tanzania, and Uganda in the worst swarm seen in decades. If not brought under control, authorities said the desert locusts could soon threaten food security across the region. Halima Athmani for VA News, Otuke, Uganda.
Maren Morris's The Bones has topped the country charts for a second straight week. It's a feat that hasn't happened for a female vocalist since Carrie Underwood's Blown Away in 2012. Maren co-wrote the song with two others for her 2019 album, Girl. But we're all right. Yeah, I sure can try to put love to it, but we... You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.
how to dumb luck, but baby, you.